From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're revisiting a conversation we had on the show recently about false confessions and some of the tactics that police officers have used to gain information during interrogations, particularly with young people. Last week, Illinois became the first state to effectively ban the use of deception by police when interrogating minors. Police officers have long relied on deceit and manipulation as a tactic to encourage people to confess to crimes, and young people are more likely to falsely confess during this type of questioning. A study from the Innocence Project found false confessions have played a role in about a third of crimes, not just among young people, that were later overturned by DNA evidence. The legislation makes confessions inadmissible in court if a police officer knowingly used deception to obtain it. Again, it only applies to minors. The idea had the support of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police and the Illinois State's Attorneys Association. It passed both the Illinois House and Senate, with no one voting against it. Last month on the program, before the governor had signed the bill into law, we were joined by Alexa Van Brunt. She's a civil rights lawyer and director of the MacArthur Justice Center Clinic at Northwestern University's School of Law. Also joining us was Chief Mitchell Davis of the Hazelcrest Police Department in the south suburbs of Chicago. He's also the president of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police. This conversation was recorded ahead of time, so we're not taking calls today, but we always love to hear what you thought about our program. Send an email, talk@21stshow.org. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, here now is that conversation. I began by asking Chief Davis the purpose behind police interrogations from his law enforcement perspective.
So an interview in a law enforcement investigation is just a tool in the investigative process. It's not the end all, but it is something that we utilize to help to bolster an investigation, to either gain additional information, to find additional evidence, or to substantiate what we may believe that we already know, or to discover new things that we have not known.
I think I've read somewhere that it's basically physical evidence, witnesses, or confessions that ultimately are what solve particularly violent crimes and murders. I wonder, what do you buy that explanation, or is that oversimplified in your view?
Well, in general, that covers it, but it's not one specific thing. It is the combination of those things that ultimately is what we're looking for. So, you know, one thing that people who are experts at doing investigations, that are doing them properly, and somebody that gives a confession, that alone should not stop your investigative process. That's, once again, that's just a tool. And even with that, you still need to go out and prove every aspect of your case that you possibly can, to make sure, first and foremost, that what's being said to you in this confession is actually true. And it's not being given to you for whatever reasons there might be. But, you know, we want the right people to be held accountable for the things that they're doing. And because, you know, just for the fact of solving a crime, that's just not enough if you're being professional about what you're doing.
Alexa Van Brunt, I want to ask you, what are some of the techniques that police use during interrogations, especially of minors, that you've seen in your work over the years?
Sure. Well, I have many clients who have been in the interrogation room and who are subjected to many pretty brutal and coercive tactics, including deception, false promises of leniency, promises that they would get to see their mom or a lawyer if they confessed, deception about the evidence that implicated them, saying that a co-conspirator had identified them when they hadn't, and in a lineup or in a statement. But then I've also seen a lot of other tactics that are beyond the bill that we're talking about today, and including threats, emotional threats, physical threats of violence, being held incommunicado, which is a particularly problematic practice, especially in Chicago, where youth and adults are kept basically locked away from the outside world, including their family, attorneys, friends, and just the pressure that is brought to bear in the interrogation rooms. It's pretty untenable. And until we had video recording in interrogation rooms, you really wouldn't believe it. What the accounts that we would get of interrogations, but now you can see some of them on videos, and it's pretty shocking. So we see all those sorts of tactics back as far back as the 80s and continuing into today.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned video. I want to play some tape now, actually. This is from a story that I covered as a reporter back in 2015. This is from an interrogation of a teenager named Trayvon Yates. He had confessed to St. Clair County Sheriff's investigators that he took part in a violent armed robbery in Belleville, Illinois, which is near East St. Louis. And ultimately, after spending 9 months in jail, the charges were dropped. The prosecutor reviewed the interrogation footage and decided that his confession wasn't really legitimate. He was set free, and the county board later agreed to settle a lawsuit with him for $900,000. Let's listen to a clip from his interrogation.
"You're lying about not playing basketball with these guys. I mean, that's one thing, too. They pointed out. They gave me your name. They gave me your last name. I had your first name. Who's this? Do you recognize anybody in this picture? Yeah, that's Trayvon Yates. He's by here all the time, plays ball with us. Trayvon, this is your opportunity. Do you want to take this by yourself? Do you want to look like a thug and a hardcore... don't care about nobody.
I'm not a thug.
Okay, I know you're not. I know you're not a thug. That's why I'm saying I don't want people to think that you are a thug. All right? Because I don't think you are the mastermind behind all this. I know there's another person involved. Okay? I have that person's name too. This is your opportunity to talk to me. Do you not think that I've talked to other people? Do you think at this point that I have not talked to anybody? You know I'm not. This is your opportunity to come forward and start manning up and telling me the truth so we can put this behind you.
Ultimately, it turns out that the suspect, Trayvon, they were looking for, his name was spelled differently. The suspect they were looking for had tattoos up and down his arm. This 17-year-old did not. I imagine you're familiar with this case because I believe
he's my client.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So
I represented him in the civil litigation, so I'm intimately familiar with that interrogation in the video.
Go ahead. If you can respond to that then, please.
I think what's so horrific about Trayvon's case is how common it is. You know, this is not a long ago interrogation. This was really recently, and it didn't happen in Chicago. It happened in St. Clair County. You know, sometimes Chicago gets all the focus of some of the police practices, but this is happening all over the state. Trayvon was ripped away from his family, and he was told that people had implicated him when they hadn't. They completely had the wrong person, but Trayvon as a kid was an easy target. And the whole goal was just to make a case stick. It was not to solve the case. And Trayvon was put through hell for 9 months plus that interrogation as a result of really, really horrific interrogation procedures.
Chief Davis, can I ask you to respond to what you heard in that tape and just this idea in general that, you know, using these manipulative tactics on younger people?
So on the surface, hearing the conversation that I heard, and in itself was not a bad conversation, but I don't know all the circumstances. As the attorney said, he was lying to the kid. You know, I didn't know that when I heard it. You know, so he wasn't being abusive to the young man. You know, he just wasn't. He wasn't being abusive to him. I didn't know he was lying to him. So, you know, once again, on the surface.
And to be fair, you listened to a 1 minute clip from, I think it was like a 2.5 hour at least interrogation. So go ahead. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the case. Like you said, I just heard that clip, but just that 1 minute was not for me as someone who sat in hundreds of investigations and interrogations and gotten confessions from people. That was not abusive that 1 minute. But once again, I don't know the totality of the circumstances and absolutely, but that goes back to my point. As the attorney was saying, and I believe you may have also said that there was other factors, that the true person had a different last name. They had tattoos where this person didn't have tattoos. That's why I said our confessions are a tool. They're not the end all to be all. You still have to complete your investigations and using the tool properly. And when people don't use that tool properly or unfairly use that tool, that's when it harms the profession, but most importantly, it harms the person who's being put through that 9 months of having to go through those things unjustly. So, you know, I'm absolutely against the outcome of what happened to this young man, and it's sad. But once again, that was the misuse of a tool that can be effective if used properly.
We're speaking with Chief Mitchell Davis of the Hazelcrest Police Department. He's also president of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police. Also, Alexa Van Brunt. She's a civil rights lawyer and director of the MacArthur Justice Center Clinic at Northwestern University's School of Law. Alexa, I want to ask you, I want to read something and ask you to respond to it. This is from a book. It's called Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets by David Simon. He was a journalist in Baltimore at the time, spent a year with the homicide unit. He later used a lot of that material. People might be familiar with the TV show The Wire. He was the creator of that show. And he's talking about police interrogations. And he says, by any standards of human discourse, a criminal confession can never truly be called voluntary. With rare exception, a confession is compelled, provoked, and manipulated from a suspect by a detective who has been trained in a genuinely deceitful art. This is the essence of interrogation. Those who believe a straightforward conversation between a cop and a criminal, devoid of any treachery, is going to solve a crime, are somewhere beyond naive. He says, if the interrogation process is, from a moral standpoint, contemptible, it is nonetheless essential. And he goes on to say that basically, if police can't confront and question suspects and witnesses, the detective often doesn't have enough physical evidence to make the case. If they can't manipulate the suspect's mind, David Simon says, a lot of bad people would simply go free. I wonder how you respond to that.
I mean, I just couldn't agree more. I think the only point I agree with Mr. Simon on is that an interrogation is an inherently coercive environment. And I think that's true. Whether or not deception is being used or not, all the interrogation techniques I mentioned before that so many of my young clients experienced are pervasive today and go beyond deception. But I could not agree more that you need to deceive people and lie to them in order to solve the case. And I honestly—
You couldn't disagree more. You don't think that's essential.
Yeah, I think it's actually counterproductive. Okay. I'm going to trial in January on behalf of a client, Daniel Taylor, who confessed falsely to a double homicide he could not have committed, and in fact did not commit. He was in police custody at the time of the murder. But because he was lied to, because he was abused, because he was coerced, he confessed to something he didn't do, and the true killers and perpetrators went free. So to say that feeding information and deceiving people in the interrogation room is effective, it is just, it's a non-starter for me. And I think it's an argument used to uphold long patterns of abuse by law enforcement.
Chief Davis, I wonder what you make of that argument. Is deception an essential tool? I mean, I guess you, the chiefs of police, supported this legislation prohibiting it for at least in interrogations with minors. Where do you come down on that?
So with minors, I think that the stakes are just too high and the margin of error too high with minors. And, you know, I don't know the exact quote, but that whole quote about I'd rather set 100 innocent people free to then lock up one innocent person, something like that. But
yeah, 100 guilty people go free, then lock up one innocent person, I think is, yeah,
so,
right.
So that's kind of, so from a minor standpoint, the stakes are real high. Now, overall, as far as adults are concerned, it depends on the circumstances. You have some adults who have the mentality and the, you know, the level of intelligence of someone who's a youngster, but yes, deception is necessary. You know, I don't know what, you know, people think that somebody who murdered somebody or somebody who's molested somebody is going to just come in and sit down with Chief Davis and say, you know what, I'm sorry, I did that. This is what I did. That just doesn't happen. You know, it may happen every once in a while, but it doesn't happen. I've had murderers confess to me. I've had child molesters confess to me, and I didn't abuse them. I never abused them. I had conversation with them. I may have been deceptive with them. I didn't lie to them. I've been deceptive with them. But yes, you need to get them to a point where they're going to talk to you. And most folks, having done those horrific crimes, are not going to sit down and just do that with you. And, you know, once again, there's rules to play by. And when you're following those rules and you treat people properly, and whether you deceive them during the investigative process or the interrogation process or not, if you're not abusing that person or violating their rights in any way, those rules are there for a reason. Then they're necessary for us to take folks who need to be off the street. But once again, it's a tool. you know, the attorney talked about she's going to court for somebody who was in jail. Well, that's easy. If I'm investigating somebody and he says, hey, well, I was in jail on that day, then that's somebody who needs, that's an officer that needs to be held accountable to a standard higher than anybody else, because that's low, that's easy to find that out. So it's not just about, oh, I got the confession. Now let's call in and get the approval on these felony charges. And so not just law enforcement, but there's a lot of folks who drop the ball in that. If this person is, especially if they're locked up and charged with a double homicide, the police, the state's attorney, somebody should have been able to say, hey, this guy was in lockup. He shouldn't have been charged in the first place. But even if it's found out afterwards, that it should have been dismissed.
Okay, we need to take a short break here and then hear more of our recent conversation with Chief Mitchell Davis, head of the Hazelcrest Police Department in the south suburbs of Chicago. He's also president of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police. We were also joined by Alexa Van Brunt. She's a civil rights lawyer and director of the MacArthur Justice Center Clinic at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. You're listening to The 21st. More to come. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last Thursday, Illinois became the first state in the U.S. to effectively ban police from using certain techniques when interrogating minors. These techniques include deception, like lying when questioning a young person. Data shows that young people are already more likely to falsely confess to crimes and potentially be wrongfully convicted. Before legislation had officially been signed by the governor, we spoke with Chief Mitchell Davis of the Hazelcrest Police Department in the south suburbs of Chicago. He's also president of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police. We were also joined by Alexa Van Brunt. She's a civil rights lawyer and director of the MacArthur Justice Center Clinic at Northwestern University's School of Law. She's also represented young clients who have experienced deceptive interrogation techniques. I asked her what makes young people more likely to falsely confess to crimes they did not commit.
Yeah, well, it comes down largely to brain development. Youth and honestly, emerging adults also up to age 24 do not have the same brain development as adults. They're more susceptible to suggestion and to coercion. They're more eager to please, especially authority figures, and they also have a difficulty envisioning or thinking through long-term consequences. So all those dynamics come to play in the interrogation room. But it's also the reason why if I had my druthers, this protection would extend up to mid-20s and to the emerging adult world, if not adults entirely.
Oh, that is an interesting point. And I know that there is a move in criminal justice to sort of raise the age at which, you know, we treat, you know, minors. It's long been established in law that people at least under 18, although that age has moved up and down a little bit over the years, are treated differently. But and there's a move to raise that age into the early to mid 20s. What about adults in use of deception with adults?
Right. Well, there's a longstanding Supreme Court case on the books, Frazier v. Cupp from the late 60s, that says police can use interrogation techniques, including with adults. And I think, honestly, if we want to do better, if we want to protect people and protect people's rights more thoroughly, that decision should be revisited. I think adults are also susceptible to the types of coercion you see in the interrogation room, especially adults. Who are vulnerable. You know, the adults who are over-policed in many of our communities or may have mental health issues or developmental disabilities. Chief Davis mentioned that some adults are, you know, maybe have issues with deceptive techniques in the interrogation room, and I completely agree. I think these protections are a great first step in this bill, but honestly, I think they should be extended at least to emerging adults, but preferably to everyone.
All right, I want to go down to the phones. 800-222-9455 is our number. Ben is on the line from Champaign. Ben, I understand you have a question for Chief Davis.
Yes, I do, and thank you for having me, and thank you all for the conversation today. I actually had two questions for the chief, just seeking a little more clarity on comments he made before your last break. The first is that the chief mentioned that sometimes he or his officers, I'm not sure, are deceptive, but they don't lie. And to me, those terms seem like synonyms, and so I'd like more clarity on what the difference is between being deceptive and lying. And then my other question was in reference to the attorney's client who had a coerced confession while he was, you know, for a crime that happened while he was in police custody. The chief mentioned that he thinks that the officer should have accountability. And of course, there are other parties, you know, the prosecutor, et cetera, who he mentioned. But what does accountability look like for that in a general sense? Does the chief think that that officer should be fired if that claim is founded? Should that officer be criminally liable? What does that accountability specifically look like? Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the questions, Ben. Chief, maybe we can take those in order. When you were talking about using deception, where is the line between deception and lying? Are there things that are inbound? Like, okay, you can say, well, we have a witness who saw you at the scene when you don't, versus if you confess, you can go free, which seems to be more patently false. Maybe you can take that where you will.
So, yeah, you kind of hit it on the head right there. As the attorney already spoke on, talking about whether or not somebody saw you or not, that's stuff that, you know, we'll say that all day long. And yeah, you know, is it lying? It may be lying. And I apologize to the caller. Yes, I've done that, done it numerous times. Yes, somebody saw you to get conversation going. Now, making false promises to people, That's something that's totally off the books. Matter of fact, I've had a confession thrown out because of that, because the defendant got to court and told the judge that he told me that if I confessed to him, I could go home. Now, did I tell him that? Absolutely not. But the judge believed him, and it was an arson case. It was a gang arson case, and the guy confessed to me. Did I tell that to him? Absolutely not. But the judge believed them. Nothing I can do about that. So that's kind of where the you talk about crossing the line, making false promises and things that are absolutely not true in that context. But as far, and I, once again, I apologize to the caller. Having lied to somebody, yeah, you know, so-and-so, we've got so-and-so in here and they said that you did. We may have that person in custody. And, you know, and then they may or may not know whether or not they've talked. So absolutely, I've done those things. And they are within the constraints of the law. Just to say something like that. As far as the penalty for the person that the attorney was talking about, it depend on the totality of the circumstances. You know, it would depend to what extent that they went to get this confession from this young man. Is it something from an administrative standpoint, from a policy and procedure standpoint, whereby as chief, I mandate that, hey, when we get a confession, we got to substantiate what's in this confession. We got to make sure that if those are the things, that might be an administrative thing that the department holds them accountable for. But if it went beyond that, it can be something criminal. So it's going to depend on the totality of the circumstances to the extent that the officer went to get that confession.
So, Alexa, I wonder, do you think you mentioned that you'd like to see the idea in this legislation expanded upward in age. Do you think this law goes far enough? You've dealt with a number of these cases over the years, you've said.
I don't think it does. I think it's a great first step. I really do. And I think in conjunction with videotaping serious crime interrogations, that it's really a strong bulwark against future misconduct. But I do think there's a lot that happens in the interrogation room beyond, you know, explicit lying. I think, you know, there's going to be the enforcement around the edges is going to be really important. Like what constitutes deception, and is, you know, suggesting, you know, covertly that somebody implicated the person being interrogated who actually didn't, is that going to be enough to throw out a statement? What actually is going to lead to a statement being thrown out? I think, you know, it should extend to adults. I think it should extend to emerging adults. I think there should be a lot more accountability for police stations or for police officers in stations who use these techniques. This law obviously applies to throw out statements that are taken in violation of the law. But Will that result in culture changes in police departments? I don't know. I think there really needs to be enforcement on the ground. And that starts with all the officers taking the statements, but it also applies to the state's attorney's offices and those state's attorneys on the ground who are approving charges based on confessions. They have to do oversight here, and they should be held to account too for approving cases that are based on evidence that involves coercive measures. So I think really accountability is the name of the game here. And I think that's where we'll see whether this is a successful legislative measure or not.
Can I share an example with you guys real quick?
Do sure.
I have time for that? So I had a homicide guy who murdered his girlfriend, dumped her body. We did was part of a task force and did an investigation. I was the person responsible for interrogating this person. Now, this went on for hours. It's not a thing where you sit there and then once again, they tell you what they've done. But this was probably this was the first case that the Major Crimes Task Force did when they required that homicide interrogations be actually recorded. It was the first one we had. It was maybe about 1999 or something like that. Well, when this finally came to trial a few years later, the defense attorney tried to get the statement thrown out because he said that the defendant thought that I was his attorney. That's why he confessed to me. And so while watching this video, the guy, he was from Belize. He had a very thick accent. And the defense attorney didn't pick up on it, but the question they asked him during the part of the videotape was, how did the officer treat you? And the guy actually started hugging me and crying because he said, I treated him so well. In spite of what he did, I treated him so well. But it was that same thing that the defense attorney was trying to get it thrown out for. There's no way you could have treated this guy that well that he would have, you know, would have been that receptive. Yes, I did. He did what he did. We talked. We didn't sit down and have cookies and milk, but we talked. It wasn't abusive. And he admitted to what he had done. So, you know, absolutely there are people out there that do things that they shouldn't do, but there are professionals out there every day that are working for victims of crimes, trying to hold people accountable who have violated these victims. And while we need to hold folks accountable, we're absolutely behind that at the Illinois Chiefs. And that's why we were behind this bill. But at the same time, those folks who are out there committing crimes need to be held accountable as well under the right guidelines and as a tool, as an investigative tool, which has to be substantiated.
You just heard my recent interview with Chief Mitchell Davis of the Hazelcrest Police Department in the south suburbs of Chicago. He's also president of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police. We were also joined by Alexa Van Brunt. She's a civil rights lawyer and director of the MacArthur Justice Center Clinic at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. They spoke with the 21st last month to discuss legislation that will make Illinois the first state to ban the use of deception or lying by police when they're interrogating minors. The governor signed that legislation into law just last week.